Hi, this is Melissa Gilbert, and you are listening to the Pop Culture Preservation Society.
Love American Style, which is where I learned the word nightcap. Would you like to come in for a nightcap? And I thought they were going to put on their nightcap.
A little hat.
I thought it was so interesting that they offered everyone a hat when they came in.
Oh, that show made me feel so naughty.
Me too.
Naughty. Yeah,
yes. Me too.
There were so many cocktails.
Hello world, is a song that we're singing. Come on, get happy. A whole lot of loving is what we'll be bringing. We'll make you happy.
Welcome to the Pop Culture Preservation Society, the podcast for people born in the Big Wheel generation who grew up in a world before juice boxes.
We believe our Gen X childhoods gave us unforgettable songs, stories, characters, and images. And if we don't talk about them, they'll disappear, like Marshall, Will, and Holly on a routine expedition.
And today, we'll be saving the shows that we were actually saving during our childhoods in a top 10 countdown of your favorite classic reruns.
I'm Carolyn.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Michelle. And we are your pop culture preservationists.
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip that started from this tropic port aboard this tiny ship. Was a mighty sailing.
We bet that when you picture your after-school time back in the 70s or the 80s, your vision includes a snack of some sort. Maybe a little can of fruit cocktail, or if you were lucky, a little can of pudding. Or if you were really lucky, a hostess treat like a fruit pie. Eaten in front of the TV while watching a rerun of an old show from the 1950s, 1960s, or early 1970s. These old shows, many of them still being shown to us in black and white, kept us latchkey kids company and became friends and storylines we could rely on, which could be one reason we watched them over and over, right?
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about your connections to these classic shows.
Well, first, I just have to say that the fruit pie is okay because it has fruit in it.
So maybe that's better than pudding.
You can't have a ding dong. That's junk food. But the fruit pie, that had like lemon filling. There was a lemon somewhere in there.
Yes.
Somewhere. I digress.
One apple slice.
Yeah. This is interesting to me because for a long time, we didn't think that this was a topic for us because these shows are mostly from the boomer era. But just consider how much of each and every day of our childhood was spent with these shows from the 50s and the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. It's a lot. It's a lot of time.
Yes. They were our babysitters, basically.
Because you'd come home from after school, just like you said, almost exclusively after school. And so when you say, what are your favorite shows of your classic reruns, it's almost not about your favorite because you just watched what was on. You didn't really even choose.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Mine is also kind of that experience too. I think of reruns and I think of my sister. Those are shows that we sat down together after school with some kind of snack and we watched, and we sometimes would play, like, you know, later on in the day, it'd be like, let's play whatever.
Yeah.
But one of our fun things I remember doing would be to guess which episode this is. Because let's say rerun isn't just once. I mean, you have seen these episodes four, five, 10 times. And so we would try to guess if we could remember which one, particularly with the Brady Bunch probably, but, you know, Leave It to Beaver and everything. And then you'd also get excited because they didn't run them in order when it was reruns, you know, so it wasn't like on regular TV. So one day, you know, Theodore Beaver is, you know, 8. And then the next day he's kind of got a little mustache kind of going on, and he's gone through puberty. I mean, how many of those TV shows did we watch some of the characters, you know, get zits and go through puberty?
Mm-hmm. And we didn't care, right? No. We did not. There was no linear thinking about it whatsoever.
No. Right.
You could see the Christmas episode after school in May.
Yes.
And you're like, oh, yay, it's the Christmas episode.
Right.
Yes.
Well, and I know I watched almost all of these shows. I don't know how or when, because let's not forget, I got sporadic TV time as a child. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing most were after school, especially the year my mom was working and my sister and I would drag the old TV out of the closet, you know, and she'd come home and feel it and see if it was hot and we'd get in trouble. But yes, Kristen, to your point, we watched them all, regardless of if we loved them or not. I have definite memories of hate watching some of them.
Oh, yes. Oh, for sure. Oh, absolutely.
But where I couldn't tear my eyes away, but at the same time, I didn't really like it and I kind of made fun of it, but it was appointment TV for me because, like I said, it was right. My babysitter.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. It was, and it's usually the only choice a lot of the time. So,
right.
There, you know, there might have been a soap opera or something on another channel. And so it was like, okay, I got to watch the Beverly Hillbillies. I don't
and
like it.
And what are you going to do?
I got to watch it.
Until dinner. Right. You're not going to do homework. That's what we were not doing.
No.
We 100% of the time did not do homework after school. Maybe somebody was. I don't know anybody who did homework. I think as I got older, I maybe did it at night, but not after school.
No. And a lot of my childhood was spent in different times in Arizona, and it's hot. Hotter than blazes right. most mm-hmm. of the year after school. So we couldn't go outside and play, or we just chose not to because it was so hot mm-hmm. that you stayed inside, you know, with all the lights off.
Lying down
and
on the couch.
Laying on the floor. Yep. Yeah. And we had like this tiny TV for my entire life. So we had to lay on the floor. It was usually hidden under a table. So we had to like pull the cloth off and lay on the floor and watch it.
I think it bears repeating that we had no limits on our screen time, except maybe Michelle, who would get busted. And it sounds like you didn't even have limits on your screen time. It's like you can't watch TV.
It's either none at all or
that's
go
right
for
or
it.
It's a free-for-all. Yeah. We had no limits on our TV, and my mom would just call us for dinner, and that's when you turned the TV off.
There's a real comfort to these reruns that
yes
just totally. Make you just feel a certain way. When I hear the first few notes of some of these theme songs, it's different than an Eight is Enough theme song or a Little House on the yeah. Prairie theme song. There is a different kind of feeling I get when I hear the beginnings of My Three Sons or something.
Yes.
It's very comforting.
It's
ritual. You know what it does, Carolyn? It gives you a funny feeling in your tummy, doesn't it?
Yes.
But it's interesting that you talk about theme songs because we should have a game show in which it's like, it's not Name That Tune, it's the reverse, where we'll say, sing the I Love Lucy theme song, sing the Andy Griffith theme song. There will be a lot of singing here today, I am guessing. And they're so imprinted on us that we not only know the theme songs, you can identify the interstitial music, like the music that they would use in the show. Like, can you tell me what the music they would play when something sad happened on the Brady Bunch? Or how about when something really mundane happened on the Brady Bunch? Mm-hmm. Do you remember that one?
It was like that.
They're walking into the garage, putting their bike away. Right?
You know what it is? It's because we heard them every day. And we've talked about this with lots of other things that we experienced in our Gen X childhoods. But we know them and feel them on a cellular level.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And that's not hyperbole here. This is like, I am dead serious. Did I use that word right? I don't know. But it's just, it's like when you say literally and people are like, no.
Is it literally?
I actually mean literally. We right. know these songs on a cellular level. They yes. are in our like makeup, in mm-hmm. our DNA.
Yes. Mm-hmm. There is something that it's trapped in the folds of your brain. In a way that is more than knowing. It's more than knowing. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. It's more than knowing.
Yeah.
And there's also something really interesting as you go through all of this. When you look at the top 10 list, that remember, we know the top 10 right now, people. We're just not telling you yet. When you look at these, how many of them came from these really weird family situations? Like there's always a missing parent. Where is that parent? Sometimes they would tell you the parent died. Sometimes they didn't. This is a research project right here. Where are all the missing parents in the reruns of our childhood?
Oh my God. That's like the best idea.
Isn't it?
For a made-for-TV movie. They're on an island like Gilligan. They're trapped somewhere. Yes. They all went on a 3-hour cruise.
Yes.
Friend and
McMurray's wife
there
is there.
There was a storm.
Yes. Surely Partridge's husband is there.
Oh my God.
All
gosh.
The Brady spouses are there.
That's right.
Does Uncle Charlie have a wife? I don't know.
No, I don't
have
know.
No idea.
Well, this is a fun fact. I was last week years old when I learned. I Love Lucy was the first television series to be broadcast as a rerun in 1955.
Oh, wow.
Did you guys know that?
Oh, no.
I don't think I did, but it's a really good. Yeah, somebody at some point said saw dollar signs and said, why don't we take this show?
Well, it's a great trivia question also. Mm-hmm. So listeners, if you ever get that on trivia night, or if you're on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire or anything, you're welcome. They used reruns during Lucy's pregnancy. That's what forced them to do it.
Okay.
And it was made possible because I Love Lucy was produced on film and not kinescope, which I guess was too grainy to rerun.
Huh.
And most other programs at the time were produced on kinescope. Everybody, just look it up. I don't have time to educate you all today on, you know, film versus kinescope. Anyway, so our hours and hours of all of this TV viewing we've been talking about is all thanks to Lucy.
Of course.
So thank you, Lucy. It's just another reason that we love you.
I mean, she started everything, pretty much. Mm-hmm. She started TV. Did she invent the TV? She probably invented the TV.
I think she did. She invented the kinescope.
So we asked our followers on social media about their favorite reruns, and once again, we were slammed with responses, which just exemplifies that this was a universal experience among us. We didn't know it at the time, but again, like I said, just think of how much time we spent with these shows on a daily basis, probably more than on our favorite primetime shows.
Oh, for sure.
Right? Well, yeah, because these were daily.
Daily, mm-hmm. as opposed to once every – we watched them seven times more. Than our favorite primetime shows.
Over years. Over like
there she goes
reading
math again.
Yes. I know. I am the mathematician. So as usual, I tallied each and every response, which is a two-person job. Like Michelle and I have to sit there together while she reads every response and I put it in its proper box and then I tally them at the end. And that takes a significant amount of time.
It took an hour
just to read one by one all of the responses. But mm-hmm. we're committed to our jobs. And then the three of us came up with our own personal top 10 lists, and those selections are weighted in an inverse relationship to their ranking. It's very complicated.
Wow.
Inverse.
Throwing out math terms like inverse.
Just trust me. Just trust me.
We do.
I can't believe I came up with this on my own. And then I got out my little professor calculator and my abacus, mm-hmm. and voila, we arrive at a mathematically sound top 10 list of your favorite reruns. I think it is worth mentioning some shows that were in our personal top 10 list that did not make the overall top 10 list because it's our show. So these are the next four places. Like we got to top 10. And yes, of course, there will be ties. So it's not 10 shows. It's like 14 shows.
Always.
But the places that came just after 10 in 11, 12, 13, 14, these are our picks that didn't make it into the top 10. The Little Rascals, Batman, The Courtship. You should see Carolyn's face now. She's like giving a grade on each one.
And when she said Batman, Carolyn was like, meh.
No,
and I'm like,
no, I didn't ask for The Little Rascals. I didn't have enough time to change my face. Batman was one of my choices.
Give me your face for Batman.
Oh,
there's a happy face. Okay, she loved Batman. The Courtship of Eddie's Father, Petticoat Junction, and Love American Style. Which is where I learned the word nightcap. would you like to come in for a nightcap? And I thought they were going to put on their nightcap.
A little hat.
Thought it was so interesting that they offered everyone a hat when they came in.
Oh, that show made me feel so naughty.
Me too.
Naughty. Yeah.
Yes. Me too.
There were so many cocktails. It was also interesting to me. There are so many shows that didn't even get close to the top 10 that really, really surprised me.
Yes.
So, for instance, Gomer Pyle only got 2 votes, hundreds and hundreds of responses, and Gomer only gets 2?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Gomer is like, he's an icon. My first dirty joke is a Gomer joke that I told to all the people at my parents' dinner party because I didn't really understand it. I told it to Mike, and he's like, I cannot believe you told that to grownups. I'm like, yeah, I thought it was pretty funny. Hogan's Heroes only got 2 votes. A lot of people love Hogan's Heroes.
Oh, wait. Why do I have
Christian,
your birthday's coming up. You guys, balloons just like floated around. Like
I didn't do
like
anything.
Like GIF balloons just floated what around is, Kristen's
face. Maybe that's the word of
screen.
The day, like Hogan or hero or something.
Hogan.
You win the Riverside.
Yeah, it looked like she just won like a sweepstakes.
Ed McMahon's going to come around the corner with my big check.
Well, my husband's like top two shows, Andy Griffith and Hogan's Heroes, like without even pause. And then when I was reading him all these that didn't get it, he goes, yeah, it's because of your demographic, which is could be
oh,
fair.
Maybe.
We have a lot of men. Listen, all our male listeners, we love you to pieces. It's true, though, that you don't have as many numbers as
that's
our
true.
Female listeners.
Right.
So
they're significant, like, but still a minority.
Yeah. Although, yeah. So that's also presuming that more males watch. That's also mm-hmm. presuming more males watch those shows.
Mr. Ed only got one vote. And I loved – when I saw that, I was like, I forgot about Mr. Ed. I loved that horse. The Beverly Hillbillies got a great showing but missed the top 10.
Good.
It was in my top 10. That was my show I hate-watched, you guys.
Oh, you hate-watched it.
Almost every day, probably. I don't know what it was. I loved it. And yet I hated it at the same time.
Granny creeped me out.
Oh, yes. Yes. The whole thing. Sometimes we didn't have a choice. It was like, that's what was on. So it's like, I got to get through Beverly Hillbillies to get to Petticoat Junction.
Yeah.
That's a really good point. I also think I was all in, and I still am, love the Beverly Hillbillies theme song.
I can sing the whole
probably
thing.
Probably that sucked me in. Mm-hmm. And then I, you know, I had my hostess fruit pie, so I might as well watch.
Fruit. It's fruit. We always ask our husbands their picks too. And one of Mike's was Gentle Ben.
Aww.
And nobody else said Gentle Ben. Mike was the only one. Lassie got 4 votes. I just didn't have enough access to Lassie. But if I had the opportunity to watch Lassie every day, I would have. I would have. I love that puppy. Andy Griffith just missed our top 10. Emergency only got 1 vote. Wah, wah, wah. I loved Emergency, Randolph Mantooth. And nobody, not one single person said Adam 12. Not
was
one
that
person.
A rerun? I was feeling like that was on
that
during
was
that
a,
time.
It was on. There were some shows that were on but also running in syndication at the same time. And Adam 12 was one of those. Star Trek got a very good showing.
It did.
But also missed our top 10.
A lot, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it's a little bit of a crime that Andy Griffith didn't make the top 10.
Mm-hmm.
That's classic.
Yeah. Carolyn's first crush.
Well, yeah. I thought, and I guess it was my first crush, but I've had some revelations, that's not the word, for being a friend, like someone I wanted to pal around with probably was Opie. But as I did some research for today's episode, I got some flutters that I forgot I had gotten back then. So I
took a little tickle.
I have
I
some
wait.
New first crushes that I'm like, of
I can't
course,
wait.
Why didn't I think of that?
This is going to be so good.
This is good.
Well, how about we share what those top 10 are? And now, without further ado, we present to you the Pop Culture Preservation Society's list of top 10 reruns from the Gen X era.
Okay, number 10 is me. Da 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 So, in our number 10 spot is The Dick Van Dyke Show, starring the legendary Dick Van Dyke as Rob Petrie, the television comedy writer who commuted into the city for his job at The Ellen Brady Show from his home in New Rochelle. Didn't we all want to live in New Rochelle? Mm-hmm. I just thought that sounded like the nicest place to live. And it has consistently been ranked as one of the greatest TV shows of all time by TV Guide, the Writers Guild of America, because it took a very familiar format, which is daddy goes off to work and mother stays home to take care of the house and the kids, and then hilarity ensues. And it stretched it to include funny women. Mary Tyler Moore as Laura Petrie, Rose Marie as Sally Rogers, and Anne Gilbert as Millie Helper. 3 funny women in one show. That was unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
You might get Lucy and Ethel, but never more than Lucy and Ethel. This was 3 funny women, and all of them were funny in wildly different ways. I remember watching this show in my high chair. I'm not even kidding you.
No.
I do. I could never
figure
out.
Were you in your high chair till you were 4?
Well, that is a good question, actually. No, I moved from that house when I was 3, so I have to be less than 3. And I also remember, coincidentally, eating my first Hostess fruit pie in that high chair and being like, what is
Carolyn,
this?
While you were watching Dick Van Dyke.
Yeah, Carolyn, I think we need to call foul on this.
Okay, I'm not putting the two of them together. I don't know if I was watching Dick Van Dyke.
Like, don't let the truth get in the way of a good story.
Yes. No, I literally remember somebody putting a lemon fruit pie on the tray and putting it in my mouth and just being like, why haven't you given this to me before? I should have been eating this every day for every meal. So I could not remember at that very tender age. I could never figure out if it was pronounced Dick Van Dyke or Vic Van Vyke. It was hard. But I eventually figured, I was like, you can combine both of them, Dick Van Dyke. The show ran from 1961 to 1966, and one of the finalists in the running to play Rob Petrie was Johnny Carson.
Are you kidding?
I am serious.
Okay, that's another good trivia question.
Isn't it?
Yeah. So it would have been called the Johnny Carson Show?
That's a really good question. They can't call it the Dick Van Dyke Show. No, the Johnny Carson Show. Isn't that interesting? But they ultimately.
Was he an actor?
Well, he must have been a comedian, right?
Okay. Maybe. Yeah.
And I guess you're just trying to get whatever work you can. Sure. Who knows? We don't know anything about Johnny Carson before The Tonight Show, really.
Well, so somebody does.
Somebody does.
We don't hear, but somebody does, yeah.
But they ultimately chose Dick Van Dyke after seeing him in a Broadway performance of Bye Bye Birdie. And I think it goes without saying that a big part of that performance and his performance in the Dick Van Dyke Show was his physicality, starting with the way he either falls over or skirts around the ottoman. Bloop, boop. Yeah. Right? That is our first introduction to Rob Petrie. And it's like, it's both graceful and it's hilarious, and I think it's kind of sexy. Just a little.
Is that what you were thinking
little,
in the high chair?
His no, little I don't think so. Exactly.
And then last but not least, my brother has said that Laura Petrie was his first crush.
I could see that.
Mm-hmm. So understandable.
And her pedal pushers.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, and you know, she fought to wear those pants, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Brazenly, because I was going to say Ellen Brady. Carl Reiner. Not Ellen Brady, but Carl Reiner, of course, insisted that she wear dresses. And she said, well, it's not realistic. I want to wear pants. And he's like, all right, you can wear pants like once every four shows. And she just quietly wore pants every show. Mm-hmm. And he didn't say anything. And she's like 22. She has
who
no
wore the
power.
Pants in that relationship.
Exactly. Right?
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Right? Somebody who ends up with her own production company. Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So in the number nine spot, this is where our ties clustered. This happens when you're at the bottom of the countdown, and we have four separate shows in the number nine spot. So Carolyn, why don't we start with you?
Okay. One of the shows at our number nine spot is Leave It to Beaver. And you guys, my personal take is that Leave It to Beaver just might be the quintessential Gen X era rerun, okay?
Oh.
I really think that. Now, stay with me here. One of the reasons I think that, at least for me, and I think for a lot of our compatriots, our age mates, is that this show revolved around a kid. I mean, a kid was the main character, right? And he was roughly our age. When Leave It to Beaver begins in October of 1957, our main character, Theodore Beaver Cleaver, is 8 years old, okay? Aww. And we watch him grow up over 234 episodes because the show ran from 1957 to 1963. Wow. And you guys, back in the day, a season in these TV shows was not 8 episodes or nine episodes. Mm-hmm. We are talking double-digit episodes. So we got a lot of episodes to watch and a lot of episodes in reruns. So we had 234 when it came to Leave It to Beaver. And I'm going to ask, did you guys watch the show?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, my God. Yes, absolutely. Because I think my dad thought he was Beaver.
Aww,
like he identified so much with Beaver. I think still to this day, he thinks he's Beaver. Like if he could embody a character, it would be Beaver Cleaver.
I love it. I love it. Well, I want to just quiz you guys a little bit and see how much you might remember about our show.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you about some of the characters. I'm going to just go ahead and tell you right now that I really do think my first crush that made my heart go pitter-patter was Wally.
Well, gee, Dad, I wasn't thinking at all. I was just concentrating on my dinner.
I think Tony Dow was my first crush, and I realized it as I was rewatching these reruns and going, yes, yes, yes.
Gee, Beav.
Yes. And he just was the all-American guy. And, you know, he's just old enough or older when I was watching to be I don't know, he was adorable. And he was a good kid because some of his friends weren't always that good. So I'm going to ask you that.
Okay.
Who were some of Wally's friends?
Eddie. What was Eddie's last name?
Eddie Haskell.
Eddie Haskell. There we go. Eddie Haskell.
Lumpy was Lumpy Beaver's friend.
That's Beaver's friend.
Beaver's friend. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So we've got Eddie Haskell.
Eddie Haskell.
And I would venture to say, well, at least in our family here, my kids have had some friends that have been reminiscent of Eddie Haskell.
Oh, yeah.
And if you remember, Eddie Haskell was the brown-nosing friend who was just, oh, Mrs. Cleaver, you look beautiful today. And, oh, this tastes so great. And then the minute the adults were out of the room, he was just the evildoer.
Mm-hmm. He was a ne'er-do-well.
Yes.
And he made me so uncomfortable.
So two-faced. Yes. And so
little rule follower Michelle.
Yes.
Like the Eddie Haskells of the world and the TV screen.
And you use that. You use the word Eddie Haskell
you
as
do.
A descriptor. He's such
you
an
do,
Eddie
yeah.
Haskell.
Oh, Andy and I would do that, like, and have to inform our children exactly what an Eddie Haskell was. So who was our dad, Kristen?
June and Ward. Ward Cleaver.
Yes, yes. We had Barbara Billingsley play June and Hugh
so
Beaumont
much.
Played Ward. And if you remember in the intro for Leave It to Beaver, they said all those names. I can't tell you that I know a lot of the names of the actors in some of the other shows that we watched. But they said them, and this it was part of the intro, so part of the theme and all of that. So I knew their names, and then Beaver's teacher was Miss Landers.
Oh, Miss Landers. That was my dad's first IRL crush, because Snow White is his first crush.
Of course.
But then his first real person crush was Miss Landers.
I love that. That's so sweet. Well, and I've got to add, because this is going to be a theme when as I share my reruns today, but one of the reasons – or. One of the qualifiers as I was trying to decide what some of my favorites were was, of course, the house. And I've got to tell you, the Cleavers had the best house. Mm-hmm. And actually, in a book I have called TV, clever name, by award-winning TV critics Alan Sepinwall and Matt Zeitz, they put that house in the number 9 spot of the best TV homes of all time.
Oh, that's interesting. And I can see it so vividly. And I can – is it on the Universal tour or something? I feel like I've driven by it on the lot.
Yes, it is, in answer to your question. Yes, it is. And interestingly enough, I don't think that Leave It to Beaver house showed up in our TV houses when we were ranking our TV houses.
I don't think
it
did
didn't.
Either.
Yeah. That's interesting.
All right. I just have a couple of fun facts. I just am going to go really fast through about Leave It to Beaver because I thought these were super interesting. One, it was the first television program to ever show a toilet. Interesting.
Oh, yeah. That is
I
fun.
Can see it, too. I can see it. I don't know what
in their
was.
We spent a lot of time in their bathroom, didn't we?
Yes, they do a lot of, like, getting ready for bed and stuff.
Yeah.
What's interesting is that's so early. And, like, if you think of shows like The Brady Bunch that came later, much later, they purposefully didn't show bathrooms because, like, oh, we don't show
it's
it.
It's naughty.
And yet there was already one shown.
There was. The first television show.
I feel like there was something with Larry Mondello in the toilet. Like, did they put something in the toilet
well,
or am I making that up?
There, the first episode where they showed the toilet, it's actually the episode is called Captain Jack. And Wally has, I guess, a pet alligator. I'm not really sure, but that's the aquarium for the alligator. So it's actually the top of the tank is off and he's playing with this little alligator.
I remembered people like around a toilet. Maybe Larry Mondello comes in and looks at the alligator. That
maybe.
Could be.
Or there could have been.
And he goes, gee whiz, Beav.
There could have been many episodes that revolved around a toilet. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I know that it was – I can see their bathroom, too. I loved their bedroom, and I thought it was so cool they had a bathroom attached to their bedroom. That, to me, was the ultimate, besides having
ultimate.
A two-story house. Because if you had a bathroom connected to your bedroom, my gosh, super cool.
And then a phone in your room?
Oh,
like dream
well,
come
please.
True.
Yeah. Yeah. A growth spurt led to a new Wally. So Tony Dow was not the original Wally. He's not the Wally in the pilot.
Oh.
But the Wally in the pilot – Paul Sullivan had this just like incredible growth spurt. And I guess he was taller than mom and dad and all that. So they had to recast him. Tony Dow just happened to be accompanying a friend on the lot who was doing an audition or something. He wasn't even there to audition. And look what happened.
What?
Is that serendipitous?
Okay, I feel bad for that Paul guy.
Damn
like,
hormones.
It's not his fault that he go into puberty. Oh, you're fired.
And my last fun fact is that Hugh Beaumont, who played our dad, he actually, once he retired, he bought a Christmas tree farm in Grand Rapids, Minnesota.
What?
And, yes, and he spent his final years in Minnesota.
I had no idea that he was one of us.
Carolyn, you always have so many great fun facts. Would you please include the ones you're not able to share in our weekly reader this week?
Yes, I will be happy to.
Oh, amazing. And listeners, if you're not subscribed already, you really should be. It's easy. Go to our website, poppreservationists.com, and you'll get our fun weekly reader with lots of fun extras from our episodes in your email inbox every Friday morning.
Also in the number nine spot, we have the Munsters. Which I called monsters, Munsters, until a kid in my neighborhood corrected me. And I was like, what the hell is a monster? I don't know what you're saying. I had Munsters in my closet.
Is that a true story too?
I mean.
Why do you think I'm lying?
Vic Van Vyke. Right. Well, no, I think it fits. I actually think it fits with the Vic Van Vyke and the Dick Van Dyke.
This is
true. And the monsters.
There were monsters hiding under my bed. And this kid is like, it's monster. Why are you saying it like that? I'm like, why are you saying it like that? Dumb. I actually think you could reboot the Munsters today and it would be a huge hit with kids.
I think it would work.
Don't you?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It ran from 1964 to 1966 and debuted only a week after The Addams Family, which aired at the same time on another network.
Right. They did that a lot.
And this explains a lot because I'm going to guess they both reran at about, you know, at the same years.
Yep.
Because I get them. I know.
I'm confused.
Listeners, don't throw things at your speaker. I get them confused a lot.
I get them confused.
And I watched one more than the other, and I always forget which one it was, but I think it was The Addams Family.
I love
that.
But
I don't
Addams.
Remember.
I it was team been Addams Family.
You were team. Yeah, you had to choose a side. Munsters or team Addams Family?
I don't know. I'm going to split the middle here. I didn't watch either of them very often. I didn't dislike them. Mm-hmm. Maybe they didn't come on when I could watch them, but I feel like I kind of liked them equally, probably because I was confused and I thought I was just watching
them.
You just
think you're watching one show.
I can't believe they were only on for two seasons.
Isn't that crazy?
Yes.
So the Munsters actually got higher ratings than The Addams Family, but even so, it was only two seasons, and that is it. And some people say that is because of Batman. They just could not compete with Batman, which was on in their time slot. But they did find much bigger success in syndication, which is so interesting
to me. Yeah, a lot of these shows, I think that's the case.
Mm-hmm. So the Munsters were a Transylvanian American family living at 1313 Mockingbird Lane in the fictional city of Mockingbird Heights, which is later revealed to be a small town outside of Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And the running gag is that they consider themselves to be just an average American family, and they don't have any idea why the door-to-door salesman is running away and screaming. They're like, I wonder what happened to him. And I used to think it was so funny that
so
they thought
funny.
Marilyn was so ugly. Like Marilyn, the niece, the cousin with the beautiful blonde hair. She looks like basically Marilyn Monroe. And they're like, oh, it's so sad. She's so unattractive.
Yeah.
I thought it was so funny. It was actually produced by the creators of Leave It to Beaver. And it was intended to be a satire of American suburban life. But even though this was a very ridiculous satirical premise, that did not stop the Munsters from addressing social issues, especially during the civil rights era. And in 2020, a speech that Herman Munster makes to Eddie in a 1965 episode actually went viral. And this is what he said.
The lesson I want you to learn is it doesn't matter what you look like. You can be tall or short or fat or thin or ugly or handsome like your father. You can be black or yellow or white. It doesn't matter. What does matter is the size of your heart and the strength of your character.
You go, Fred.
Sounds like he was running for
Fred
office.
Gwynn.
I know.
Herman
Fred Gwynn. Yes. Yes, who played Fred Herman Gwynn, Munster. Yeah. Can't you just see Herman Munster like being our hero?
Okay. And yet another show making our number nine spot is the Mickey Mouse Club.
Who's the leader of the club that's made for you and me?
M-I-C-K-E-Y-M-O-U-S-E.
Hey there, hi there, ho there, you're as welcome as can be.
M-I-C-K-E-Y-M-O-U-S-E.
Mickey Mouse.
Mickey Mouse.
Forever let us hold our banner high.
This is the original one that ran from 1955 to 1959. And then, in response to an upsurge in demand from baby boomers, the show again went into syndicated reruns from January 1975 until January 1977, which explains a lot. That's my sweet spot for this show. I'm 5 to 7 years old. And you guys, to say I was obsessed is not strong enough. I'm wearing my original Mickey Mouse Club sweatshirt right now. I loved this show. Again, the Mickey Mouse Club was hosted by Jimmy Dodd, who was a songwriter and, of course, the head Mouseketeer. And then the most popular of the Mouseketeers, who were the so-called Red Team, were kept under contract for the entire run of the show from the 4 years, 1955 to 1959. And I'm just going to say their first names here because that's how we know them, right? Mm-hmm. It was emblazoned right on the front of their shirt. And right now I have this idea. We should get those shirts.
I want that.
Wouldn't that be really cute?
Because didn't you want to be a Mouseketeer?
Of course.
Who didn't?
Yes.
We need those shirts, you guys.
I know.
And you know what? That's a great shirt to just wear around. And if you know, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we can't forget. We have Sharon, Bobby, Lonnie, Tommy, Annette, Darlene, Cubby, Karen, and Doreen.
Oh, I love Cubby and Karen.
I was just about to say that, not surprisingly, you guys know from 3 years of these conversations, I always gravitated toward the little sister, the little one, the Gretel, the Cindy. I was a huge Cubby and Karen fan. I think little romantic 5-year-old Michelle, like I wanted them to be like a couple. And they put them together a lot because they were the two younger ones, but they would have them sing little songs together. Do you remember Karen's like corkscrew curls, and it was back really tight right here with her little Mickey Mouse ears on, and then all the curls coming out. I loved it. And we also all know from one of our Carpenters episodes that in 1973, Cubby O'Brien went on to be the drummer for the Carpenters when Karen was forced to step away from the drums to the front of the stage, which was super sad for Karen, super great for Cubby. And this is a fun fact. One of the other Mouseketeers who were members of the, you know, the white or the blue teams, basically like the bench warmers, right? Those teams didn't get this amount of screen time. Aww. His name was Don Agrati, who was later known as Don Grady. Does that ring a bell?
No way.
Well, do. That's a great segue.
It's going to be a good segue. We will get to that in just a minute. But yes, he starred as Robbie on My Three Sons. One of my favorite things about the Mickey Mouse Club was that each day of the week had a special show theme. So the themes were Monday was Fun with Music Day. Tuesday was Guest Star Day. Tuesday is Guest Star Day. Wednesday was Anything Can Happen Day. Thursday was Circus Day. And do you guys remember what Friday was?
No.
Saddle your pony, here we go, down to the talent rodeo. Gather up Susie, Jack, and Joe, join the talent roundup.
Round them up, bring them in,
everybody's sure to win. Step right up, here we go, oh, what a rodeo.
Friday was talent roundup day, and it was like a little talent show on the Mickey Mouse Club. Listeners, they're looking at me like they've never seen it.
I don't know that I have.
The Mickey Mouse Club was a place where my mom got very involved in our TV watching.
I was going to say
that. She was very nostalgic. Mm-hmm. And she had a cousin named Sharon Baird, which is not the same Sharon Baird. They just have the same name. But for some reason, my mom thought that was something that like we needed to claim.
Well, if you think about it, our parents, I mean, my mom would have been like 12 when the Mickey Mouse Club started. So it could be a show that they watched.
And then you have the whole Annette Funicello. Then she becomes the star in the beach movies.
The Beach Blanket Bingo lady. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it was fun because as very small children, you know, I don't know that I necessarily understood that these kids like Karen and Cubby that I'm watching in 1974 – 75 are from 20 years ago.
Oh, no.
I'm
no
not sure
idea.
That I'm realizing that they're now 30 something. And, you know, currently Cubby is playing drums for the Carpenters that I'm also listening to. So I remember when I think I realized all of that, I was just gobsmacked. Like, wait, that's Annette Funicello? Wait, what?
No idea. In general, with any of these shows, I did not know that they came from a different era. I just thought they were in black and white.
Right. Mm-hmm. And they're frozen in time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. We have one last entry in the number 9 spot, and then we'll move on. I promise. And in the last number 9 spot is The Partridge Family, which came in at number 5 on my own personal top 10 list.
Hello, world. Hear the song that we're singing. Come on, get happy. A whole lot of love.
elusive show for me. It was not like some of these shows that were on daily throughout our childhoods. It was more like a short appearance on a Saturday afternoon at 2 p.m. before it disappeared and got replaced with something like F Troop, which would just piss me off. I don't care about F Troop. So this only added to my attachment to the show that I didn't have access to it all of the time. I just couldn't scratch the itch enough because it was the perfect formula for a show that I would love. It was the cute kids. It was a crush-worthy star plus a musical montage in every episode. It was tailor-made for me. It was a pop culture juggernaut, the Partridge Family was. When you consider what it contributed to the culture at the time, for the parents, you had a weekly appointment with Shirley Jones, one of the most beloved songbirds of their generation. And for the kids, you had a garage band playing irresistible radio-friendly bubblegum pop tunes that they parlayed into 10 albums in 4 years, 11 hit singles, including the forever classic number one smash, I Think I Love You. They also had an animated show on Saturday mornings. And last but not least, this pop culture juggernaut gave us possibly the biggest teen idol of all time, David Cassidy.
I'm surprised it was number five on your list. I thought it would be probably in the top three for sure.
It was very difficult making these lists. And if I went and did it again, it would probably – it would be all mixed up. So at a moment in time, you just have to take what you've got and run with it, right? So the show ran in primetime from 1970 to 1974 and was originally supposed to star the real-life family band, the Cowsills, who did the song, remember, The Rain, the Park, and Other Things?
That I do.
About that.
Yeah.
In our Sunshine Pop.
Our Sunshine Pop.
Yes. Yeah. The Rain, the Park, and Other Things. But when the real life family looked a bit too real, aka too old and dysfunctional and also not actors, they decided to turn the show into a fictionalized version of them. It was part of the Friday night lineup alongside the Brady Bunch, which often led to the question, who do you like better?
Yeah.
The Partridge Family or the Brady Bunch? And for me, unless I was watching The Silver Platters, the answer was always The Partridge Family. So because of the Cowsill situation, there are two pilots for the show. In the original pilot, which was never broadcast, Shirley Jones's name is Connie. And she has a boyfriend played by, first of all, I don't want her to have a boyfriend. I'm not comfortable with it. Jack Cassidy, her real life husband, played her boyfriend in the original pilot. And instead of living in San Pueblo, California, they live in Ohio. And for my brother's 50th birthday, I gave him a copy of the TV guide from the week he was born, which was in September of 1970 when The Partridge Family premiered. And there's an ad for this new show, The Partridge Family, with this storyline. It's about Connie and her boyfriend and her kids in Ohio.
Oh, that's so cool.
Wow.
It's really trippy. So the new and improved Partridge Family from the pilot that actually aired, divinely featuring David Cassidy, who would grace the world with his presence, they lived in the fictional city of San Pueblo, California, which I always pictured to be somewhere in the cool part of California, like near Los Angeles or near the beach or something like that. But in episode 24, they mentioned that San Pueblo is 40 miles from Napa County.
Oh.
I know. So the show has always been beloved and so, so emblematic of the 70s, like uber 70s, yeah. Right? Which is why it has been like prime fodder for reunion specials and appearances, the first being in 1977, when they came together for a special called Thanksgiving Reunion with the Partridge Family and my three sons.
Of course.
There was no link between these two shows. At all. I don't know why they thought it was a good idea to put them together, but they did. As if the Partridge Family couldn't carry a Thanksgiving reunion special by themselves. I don't know. There was no link. And in the 1990s, especially, the 1990s was like a Gen X explosion of 70s culture, and the Partridge Family was front and center. Hey, everybody, a quick message. Today's episode is brought to you by Book of the Month, a monthly book subscription box that helps readers discover new books from up-and-coming authors.
The process of choosing your book is so easy and fun. Besides the website and app being really easy to navigate, the smaller but varied monthly selection, which always includes an anticipated new release, by the way, means I'm not overwhelmed with too many choices, and it's truly easy to make a decision. And let's be real, we're all about simplicity right now, aren't we?
Oh, mm-hmm. Definitely. So you guys, I was thrilled when I saw that this month's selections included a book I have been anticipating for over a year. I chose The Paradise Problem by Christina Loren. It is rom-com at its finest. Think Pretty Woman meets Succession.
Ooh. I chose Spitting Gold by Carmela Locus about two shady spirit mediums in 19th century Paris. I mean, come on, you had me at shady spirit mediums, right? This is a brand new hardcover book, and I'm getting it for less than I could get it anywhere else.
And great news, you can get your first book for only $5 using the code PETALS when you order at bookofthemonth.com. That's PETALS.
You guys, we love Book of the Month, and we know you will too. Well, Kristen, you didn't think that the Partridge Family and My Three Sons had any kind of link?
No, I didn't. Was I wrong?
Well, you might be, because guess what number 8 is in our top 10 TV reruns?
Tell us, Carolyn.
That would be My Three Sons. Another one of my absolute favorites for several reasons, okay, everyone? I do believe, and I hope that I don't ever find out that this is not true, but I believe, again, House loved it. This is one of my favorite houses.
Yeah.
I think they had a Dutch door.
They did. Yes,
yes.
Uncle Charlie would open the Dutch door.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you, because that began my obsession and love of Dutch doors. And to this day, mark my words, I will not go to my grave without having a home that has a Dutch door. Thank you very much. The end. I want you to know.
We're going to put one in our nursing home.
It might have to be there. I don't know. But I am going to have a Dutch door. And I'm going to put a pie on it.
Yes.
And you're going to come. My neighbors can come over and get the pie. I don't know how I'm going to keep insects and birds and stuff out of my house. That's been my dilemma. But I'll figure it out. Okay. My Three Sons, you guys. 12 seasons, 380 episodes.
Wow.
It is considered to be the second longest running live action sitcoms in TV history. Here is our cast. So we are the Douglas family, okay? Mm-hmm. We had Stephen Douglas, our dad, our patriarch. He was Fred McMurray.
We've
fallen in love with Fred McMurray recently in the Disney movie Shaggy Dog.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Oh, yeah, of course. Well, he was in a lot. He was a big Disney movie.
Yes, he was in a lot. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. Shaggy Dog was like his splash onto. He'd been in a lot of movies, but nothing that had the impact of the Disney movie Shaggy Dog. Mm-hmm. Coincidentally, one of our other characters is Tramp. Okay, he's our family dog who happens to be very shaggy and also happens to have been trained by the same trainer as Benji.
Oh, what?
I know. And then I realized, again, upon watching some of these reruns, that my other crush would have been Don Grady as Robbie Douglas.
Oh, totally. Oh, my gosh. Oh, when Robbie and Katie got married?
Oh, when he married Tina Cole, when he married Katie. Oh, and then they had
had triplets.
Yeah, they had triplets because you had to have My Three Sons again.
Why didn't they just make Ernie one of the sons? Why did they have to have this story of him being like a neighbor's kid and then they adopt him? Why?
Right. Yeah. Well, he was with a foster family and then the foster family was getting transferred somewhere overseas.
Okay.
Because our oldest brother, Mike Douglas, who was played by the actor Tim Considine, he didn't want to renew his contract. He was not going to be in the show anymore. So they basically write him off, and he gets married, and he has to go do a job somewhere. So
you just answered a question I've had for decades.
Oh, there you go. So that's why they brought in Ernie, because we still needed to have three sons.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. All those boys were so sweet, and they were so real. I mean, that was one of the things. This was one of the first TV shows that kind of showed a real family. Like, the house was sometimes kind of messy. The boys were kind of bickering a lot, as brothers would do. So the beginning few seasons, we actually have William Frawley is Bub, their grandfather. So he is their maternal grandfather. So the mother who, when the series started, has passed away 6 years prior to the show's beginning. So Chip would have only been like 2 years old, which makes me really sad when I think about it. But William Frawley, a.k.a. Fred Mertz, he is our kind of caretakers. But then William Frawley gets sick in real life, and so we're going to have to replace him. And we do that with Bub's brother. This would be Uncle Charlie.
Oh, okay. I did not know all of these origin stories. I had no idea.
Well, I'm glad I can educate.
The rainbow's so shooting across
yes,
the screen right
it
now.
It is.
Coming out of your speakers.
We were talking about our favorites, Mike and I said my three sons, and he immediately starts going like this. Dee dee dee.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Dee 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 dee. You got your hands going.
Yeah.
Dee dee dee. And you remember, I was thinking before we were talking theme songs, so many of the theme songs for these shows didn't have words, but man, can we hum them and dee 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 them and everything?
We can dee 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 them.
And we can dee 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 a good
one. And we can make our hands go like this.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
I loved that. Yes, I loved that.
Taking the number 7 spot on our top 10 list is the Flintstones.
We ever never knew.
Flintstones, meet the Flintstones.
The Flintstone was my personal number 6 on my list because I feel like in my memory, this was a show in a block, I don't know, with the Brady Bunch or Gilligan's Island or something, because I feel like I watched the Flintstones every single day after school. The Flintstones was originally broadcast on ABC from September 30th, 1960 to April 1st, 1966, and was the first animated series with a primetime slot on television. And the only animated show to make our list.
Isn't that interesting? Did you guys know, though, that it was a primetime show?
Nope.
I only learned that. I think we talk about that in an earlier episode that we've done. I can't remember what
episode that would be. Yeah, I feel like we did too. Maybe cartoons or something.
Maybe. I think it was probably our Saturday morning cartoon. But yeah, that was super interesting to me because I'm thinking, isn't cartoon for kids? And yeah.
It was like their Simpsons, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think I thought it was happening in real time for us. Sorry to interrupt you, Michelle, but I didn't think that this show had been out in the early 60s. Like, I thought it was out now, when I was watching it.
Yeah, me too, for sure.
Absolutely. I was shocked to find out that it was a 60s show. Well, the main voice actors, Alan Reed voiced Fred, and then Mel Blanc voicing Barney, also very famously known for voicing who?
Bugs Bunny.
Bugs Bunny, that's right, and Daffy Duck and Heathcliff. Jean Vanderpelt voiced Wilma, also Pebbles, Rosie the Robot Maid. Remember that cartoon?
Yes.
I feel like I know it in title, but maybe I didn't watch it. And then Benadurette, I don't know her last name, but she voiced Betty.
Can we just stop for a second and say how those voices, I mean, I can hear them in my head. But I would have never known any of those actors that you mentioned.
I don't know any of those names.
Like, those poor people, like, their voices are part of our childhood.
And that's right.
I couldn't tell you who they were, what they looked like.
Well, and like I'm going to talk about with another show in a little bit that's at a higher spot on our list, I loved this show for all the kind of primitiveness of it, like all the things that they made from stone or, you know, the utensils they used, or
the bowling ball.
Running with their feet in the car. Yeah.
So in our number 6 spot is Family Affair with that iconic theme song by Frank Duvall, played over the opening credits, and this kaleidoscopic view of a multicolored array of gems and precious stones. I'm reading that directly from Wikipedia because I didn't know how to describe it.
Well,
how do you describe
odd.
How it
it's
is?
It's so odd.
What was that?
Right?
You could have shown, like, I think you should have shown, like, interior shots of that apartment, which I'm sure you're about to talk about. But, like, that would have been better. That it's so bizarre.
But I loved it. And I remember asking my mom, this happened a lot, actually, because I didn't know titles of shows. And I remember asking her for The Diamond Show. I want to see The Diamond Show. She's like, what?
That's
what are you talking about?
Funny, because we called it Buffy and Jody. Like, I didn't even know it was called Family Affair.
That's random. It feels so random. Family Affair ran from 1966 to 1971 and explored the trials of a wealthy New York bachelor. This is probably where we learned the word bachelor, too. In his ginormous Upper East Side apartment with his manservant, Mr. French, played by Sebastian Cabot. That's a name we'll never forget.
Right.
And we know that bachelor as Uncle Bill. Or
no, you know
Uncle
Beal.
Uncle Beal. Yes. Because he is the guardian of twins Buffy and Jody and their older sister Sissy, who were orphaned when their parents were killed in a car accident. There's so much tragedy. Mm-mm. Why did they do this? So actually in the script, Buffy and Jody were different ages. But when they saw Johnny Whitaker and Anissa Jones together, they just looked so cute that they decided to cast them both and make them twins. Oh. Everyone loved Buffy and Jody. And I wonder, how come there weren't more babies named Buffy after that? Weren't you so enamored of Buffy?
I loved them both so much. I feel like it's about the time we started this podcast, and I feel like maybe I posted on social media and everybody, you know, went nuts with their Buffy dolls and their Mrs. Beasley dolls and their whatever. And so it forced me to go back and find it on Tubi or YouTube, TV, whatever. And I started watching it again, and I was watching it like every night. It probably only lasted for a couple of weeks. But you guys, those first few episodes, they could like fit in the palm of your little hand, and they are so sweet to each other. They embodied that twinness, right? You forget completely that these are just two non-related actors. Because they're like stuck together and they're so sweet. And I highly recommend watching that if you just need
It'll make you feel good. And you can see where they would be like, we have to cast these two people. Cast these two little children. I had, when my mom would do my hair in the morning, I had an array of choices for what my hair could be. And I often chose Buffy tails. I could have high ponytails. I could have low ponytails. I could have Buffy tails. So the Buffy tails would be high ponytails curled up.
With the little
twisted yarn ribbons. Yes. But you mentioned another one of the cultural touchstones from this show. Raise your hand if you had a Mrs. Beasley doll or if you put the Mrs. Beasley's glasses on your own face.
It was my sister's favorite doll. So it wasn't mine, but it is a part of my childhood memory because it was everywhere in our house. Yeah.
And think about how weird that is. Like, why would you make a doll of an old lady?
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
It doesn't make any sense.
And it is crazy. I mean, listeners, we know you right now are all scrambling, screaming. Yes. I love my Mrs. Beasley because we've seen your comments on social media. Yes. And we've also seen all the comments that say that. Mm-hmm. Why we loved a doll that looked like an old lady. There's a couple that say, no, that doll creeped me out. But overwhelmingly,
most of us loved her.
People loved Mrs. Beasley.
And I always wondered, you know, chicken or the egg. Did Buffy have a Mrs. Beasley doll because it was a popular doll? Or did we have a Mrs. Beasley doll because of Buffy? It is the latter that is true. It turned out that Family Affair was so popular with little girls that they took this doll that they had made for the show and they mass produced it. And we all got it for Christmas.
Well, and there's also a very popular Buffy doll holding a tiny Mrs. Beasley. That's also a popular one. Maybe we'll post that in social media this week.
Anyway, I like Mrs. Beasley better than a big old bear.
Okay, well, coming in at number 5, and one that I loved, of course, because I loved where she lived, this would be I Dream of Jeannie. Boy, did I have visions of what that bottle held, what the bathroom would have looked like. I would sit and imagine that. So this series ran from September of 1965. That's the year and of my birth, month of my birth. Actually, one day after my birth, September 18th. And
you're an I Dream of Jeannie baby. Yeah. I Dream of Jeannie baby.
So the series ran from September 18th, 1965 through 1970 on NBC. And it was created in response to a show that we'll hear about a little bit later, Bewitched, as kind of competition for that. That ran on ABC, and I Dream of Jeannie was on NBC. It was created by a name you might recognize, Sidney Sheldon.
Oh, yes.
Also a very popular author of some popular novels during the time, The Other Side of Midnight and Rage of Angels, which, the way, became a miniseries, and I think Jacqueline Smith was in it. But that's...
Did all of our mothers carry those? Yes, but I read them.
Naughty.
I did. I loved Rage of Angels. Yes, I read that and I watched the miniseries. So I think I felt really grown up. Okay, so if you recall, Barbara Eden played a genie whose name was Jeannie. How clever, right? And she and her bottle had been discovered when the astronaut Captain Tony Nelson, played by Larry Hagman, J.R. Ewing, lands his space capsule on a deserted island. Okay, this scene is replayed in the opening of every episode of I Dream of Jeannie. You might recall it. Again, it is animated, and we have the capsule landing. Captain Nelson comes out, and he bumps his door of the capsule onto the bottle. And then, you guys remember, it falls over, and then poof, this kind of like smoke comes out. And so Barbara Eden or Jeannie's head comes out
first.
But no, where's her body? Well, then, whoosh, her body is a thing of smoke. It comes out and it like.
And they're like dancing.
Sashays over to the head. And then they kind of do a little belly dancing thing. And then she kind of belly dances over to Captain Nelson and gives him a little peck on the cheek. And then all of the names of, you know, the credits come out of that little puff of smoke. And then there's another iconic instrumental theme song that accompanies that.
See, it's a game show.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I Dream of Jeannie theme. Jeannie theme.
The cast also includes Bill Daly. Do you guys remember who else Bill Daly might have been?
Mm-hmm. Was he was on the Bob Newhart show.
Yes, he was Howard on the Bob Newhart show. He was Major Roger Healy on I Dream of Jeannie. And then Major William Healy. Henry Rourke played Colonel Alfred Bellows. Basically, he was like the Mrs. Kravitz of the show. He always could see Jeannie and all the weird things he did, and then he'd go to show his wife. And no, it wasn't there. And Roger was kind of in on it. Roger kind of knew about Jeannie, but he always, you know, always tried to pull the wool over Colonel Bellows' eyes as well. So that was just so funny when I was watching some of these that all came back. And you know what? No matter how many times I watched those reruns, I kept thinking that this was going to be the one where they got caught. Like, oh no, what's going to happen? Because he's going to see her. What are we going
to
do?
And it never occurred to you that if that happened, the show would be over.
Right.
Well, eventually, you guys, the show has Jeannie and Captain Nelson getting married. Okay. So we've got a lot of kind of sexual tension up until that point. You know, he kind of dates other people, but we can tell they really like each other. But then the network executives, they kind of got a little concerned about this image of these main characters living together.
Oh.
So they decided they had to get married. And guess what? Barbara Eden said that was the demise of the show. The season that they had them getting married. Was the last season of I Dream of Jeannie.
Yeah, because didn't she start dressing in like normal clothes and stuff?
Yeah, she had to be more mortal, I guess. And and it lost its...
The tension was gone.
Its zing. Exactly. She said that Jeannie should have just stayed kind of that character that interrupted all the dates that Captain Nelson would go on. And just that was kind of her role. So so we saw our last episodes in 1970 after they got married, which was actually a popular episode. Like, it was a big deal when they got married. But then everything after that was kind of,
nobody cares after
that. No more Jeannie.
And I used to fantasize about her bottle. I wanted my bedroom to be like that bottle.
Right. Yes. Oh, that bottle was everything.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That was everything. And
I loved her ponytail.
Yes.
Oh, for sure.
Off the top of her head.
I still love that ponytail.
Mm-hmm. Here we come, walking down the street. We get the funniest looks from everyone we meet.
Hey, hey, we're the monkeys.
In our number four spot is my number one pick.
I knew it would be your number one pick.
It is my number one pick. The number four pick in our top 10 is the Monkees. And much like the Munsters, I thought monkey was spelled M-O-N-K-E-E. And I wrote it like that, like in my school papers and everything. And when it came back crossed out and spelled M-O-N-K-E-Y, I just thought the teacher was wrong. I can't believe she doesn't know how to spell monkey.
Well, we did have some people vote for the Monkees, and they spelled it that way.
Oh, M-O-N-K-E-Y?
Correct.
Oh, that is not correct.
I know. Well, you know what? We can forgive a lot of things, listeners.
Right.
That one and spelling Sean Cassidy incorrectly are two things that the three of us really can't forgive.
We can't be friends. Yeah. So the show was on in prime time for only two seasons, from 1966 to 1968. And along with the Partridge Family, the Monkees was my ultimate sweet spot, combining these crush-worthy characters and musical montages. And together, they formed the foundation of my crush history, pretty much. This is where I live, people. This is where I learned how to have a crush. And when I was watching the Monkees, now I was old enough to watch it with other people who were also there for the crushes like I was. And we divvied them up according to size and personality. Everybody gets a monkey. And I was, I originally was attracted to Mike Nesmith. I liked his sort of no nonsense approach to shenanigans, and the beanie, of course.
Wait, I'm sorry. Everybody stop. Everybody stop. Somebody please write that down.
The no nonsense.
Yeah, I'm thinking she said it so seriously too. And I was originally attracted to Mike Nesmith. I really liked his no nonsense approach to shenanigans.
Yes, and I'm like 6 years old, but that is what I think.
No, she is probably sitting in a high chair. Yeah. Wait a minute. I also just want that to be like some sort of tagline.
Yeah.
Like no maybe our pop culture preservation society. Yes. A no nonsense mm-hmm. approach to shenanigans.
I really liked it. I just it's he great. Was sort of like the Kate Jackson of the Monkees. Right? It was my favorite angel. Oh, oh. But then I was told that I couldn't have Mike Nesmith. I had to have Davy Jones because we were the same size. And you know what? That worked for me. That was great because that face is there. There's probably there has never been a more cherubic face in the world, maybe, than Davy Jones. In Crush history, for sure. In Teen Idol history, there's never been a more cherubic face. That face is responsible for the explosion of Tiger Beat magazine because it was like a struggling magazine until somebody saw a picture of Davy Jones and they were like, "Get him on the cover now!" And then. Voila, we have Tiger Beat. And then when they put the little animated stars in his eyes when he fell in love. I mean,
I loved that. I loved
that. I'm done. Let's get married, right? Like today. So the Monkees' Greatest Hits album was the first album that I bought by myself with my own money, with my own agency, right? And it is the album that I know best in my whole collection because my whole neighborhood was involved in this collective crush experience. Even the boys. The boys loved the stupid shenanigans, and they thought they were hilarious. There was one neighbor boy whose mom wrote on his watch in Sharpie, like in permanent marker, she wrote the minute, the hour hand to the 4 and the minute hand to the 12 so that when the hands of the clock matched up, it was time to go in for the Monkees.
Oh. That's like mom of the year.
Yeah. And it was very helpful for the rest of us because Kevin would be like, "You guys, it's lining up." And we would all run inside. It was time
like
for the Monkees.
Eclipse.
So we listened to that record constantly with everyone. This was a neighborhood experience. And we heard those songs not just on the album, but in the show, in the musical montages that I loved so much. These songs were imprinting on us. The marketing is genius, especially for a show in syndication. The Greatest Hits album was released 10 years after the show was canceled. It's
wow.
so brilliant. And I, like we've discussed, and like subsequent generations, did not know that these were reruns. I did not know that the Monkees didn't exist in this form anymore. There is so much dirt about the Monkees that we could never fit it in my little segment right here. It definitely deserves a future episode.
Okay. Well, at number 3, we have a really big tie. These two shows are huge, huge. And obviously, they tied for number 3. And the first one I'm going to talk about is Gilligan's Island.
Mm-hmm. Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip. That started from this tropic port aboard this tiny ship.
Gilligan's Island was an easy number 2 on my personal list. And you know what I think would be fun, you guys? Let's share our own top 10, our own personal top 10 lists in this week's Weekly Reader. This is going to be a big Weekly Reader this week, you guys. If you're not subscribed yet, definitely the week to do it. But I think that would be fun for people to see how y'all ranked these. I feel like I've seen every episode of Gilligan's Island. I loved this show, despite the fact that it filled me with so much anxiety. I wanted nothing more than for them to be rescued. And like you said, Kristen, with I Dream of Jeannie, I wasn't realizing or didn't care that if they got rescued, the show was over. Every episode, I wanted them to be rescued, and they almost did.
Almost.
Like every episode. It seemed like they were always almost getting radio frequency to send a distress call or almost getting the boat fixed. And it drove me bananas. But I loved how they made, like I said, with Flintstones, they made all the everyday objects out of things like coconuts or palm fronds.
So funny.
The professor even made a lie detector machine from, I don't know, it was like bamboo and vines or something. And I loved the frequent dream sequences that they always had where they all played kind of like different characters in the dream. And fun fact, those were also the cast members' favorites to film, apparently. And, Gilligan's Island was created and produced by Sherwood Schwartz. And this is shocking to me. It ran for just 3 seasons.
Oh, my God. You're
kidding. On CBS from September 1964 to April 1967, 98 episodes, which is confusing because I thought you needed 100 to go into syndication.
That must be a rule that was instituted in the 70s because there are so many of these 60s shows that were way less than 100.
The show's ensemble cast, as we all know, features Bob Denver, Alan Hale Jr., Jim Backus, Natalie Schaefer, Tina Louise, Russell Johnson, and I don't know about you guys, but my favorite, Don Wells. Marianne was my favorite. Carolyn, did you have a favorite?
Oh, I'd say, yeah, Marianne too.
Just some interesting things, tidbits about some of this cast. Bob Denver, from 1959 to 1963, of course, played Maynard G. Krebs, the beatnik friend of Dobie Gillis. And that was right before Gilligan's Island. Alan Hale Jr. had a huge resume. And you guys, he was kind of hot.
What?
Go back and look. Kind Skipper? Of young Alan Hale Jr. I'm just saying. Just okay. Throwing it out there for you. The darling of Gilligan's Island, like we just said, our favorite Marianne, Don Wells, died sadly from COVID on December 20th, 2020 at age 82. And up until her death was still doing the celebrity meet and greet circus at all those cons, you know. Post Gilligan's Island, if you remember, we saw Don Wells on everything from Fantasy Island to Love Boat to Alf. In 1959, Don Wells was crowned Miss Nevada and represented her state in the Miss America 1960 pageant in Atlantic City. Oh, I can see that.
Not Tina Marie.
No, Tina. Mm. Tina Louise.
Oh, Tina Louise.
Tina Louise.
Tina Marie is Rick James's girlfriend.
Well, Tina Louise at age 90 is the last surviving star.
Carolyn's losing it. She's still alive.
Yeah, she's 90.
Oh, wow.
So Gilligan's Island received very solid ratings during its original run and then grew in popularity during decades of syndication.
There you go.
Which is what we all contributed to, right? Especially in the 70s and 80s when many markets ran the show in the late afternoon.
Yep.
After school, guys, yep. Grab your hostess, grab your fruit cup.
I mean, that whole latchkey kid thing that we talk about and all that, that all just lends itself to.
So we can connect that to the laws that made no-fault divorce so that we had a wave of divorces, so we had all the moms going back to work, so that we had latchkey children who came home and watched TV for hours at a time.
That's
true. Were the success of the show.
Well, and according to Wikipedia, all that watching by us contributed to this. All the characters of Gilligan's Island are today recognized as American cultural icons.
Yeah, for sure.
I can totally see that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys remember this. I remember watching this in 1978. We get the first sequel movie where they get rescued. Hooray! Only to take a reunion cruise and get shipwrecked again.
I'd be so pissed.
God, it's so great. And you guys, I feel like I remember the feeling of anger that boiled inside me.
I do. Like I felt like he tricked me.
Right?
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, all right. Well, tying at number three with Gilligan's Island is I Love Lucy. My biggest memories of watching I Love Lucy are watching every day after school in high school, like 84, 85. Yes. But also, I do know that even then, they were reruns to me. So again, when did I watch it? I can't figure it out, but I had watched it at some point. I loved it. I Love Lucy originally aired from October 15th, 1951 to May 6th, 1957, with a total of 180 episodes spanning 6 seasons. And it always aired on Mondays from 9 to 9:30 on CBS, the entire run, same time slot.
Wow.
It's time slot. So let's talk reruns. Like I said earlier, I Love Lucy was the first show to be rerun. It was the first scripted television program to be filmed on 35 millimeter film in front of a studio audience, won 5 Emmy Awards and received many nominations, honors. And it was the first show, I think this is so fun. This is a fun fact. It was the first show to feature an ensemble cast.
Oh, that's interesting. And here we are today. Making ensemble cast shows. We have a whole award category for ensemble cast.
I love ensemble cast shows.
I love ensemble cast.
So because of that, it's often regarded as both one of the greatest and most influential sitcoms in history.
Oh,
and
without
in
a doubt.
2012, it was voted the best TV show of all time in a survey conducted by ABC News and People Magazine. I don't know if I agree with that.
I'm saying yes. I'm totally there. Of all time. When you think about the ground that it broke, when you think about what Lucille Ball did on her own against insurmountable odds, that she was in charge of that show. She was in charge of that company. She was in charge of that script. And there were no women anywhere. Nothing. And my God, she's funny. So funny.
In 2013, the Writers Guild of America ranked I Love Lucy number 12 on their list of the 101 best written TV series. And because I know you two and most of our listeners are wondering, here are the top three.
Okay.
At number three is The Twilight Zone. Number two is Seinfeld. And the number one best written TV series, according to the Writers Guild of America in 2013, is The Sopranos.
Oh, yeah. You got to think timing, right? Mm-hmm. I wonder how long that will hold. Someday there's going to be some show that's going to bump Sopranos.
As if we don't have enough this week, I am going to put a link to this list in this week's Weekly Reader because it's actually super interesting. Brandon and I went through all 101 of them the other day because it was really interesting.
And it's not once you get into comedies. The 90s,
you're like, no, it's just best written
TV
series.
Right, just best written TV series of all time. So for Lucy to be in there is pretty amazing.
Coming in at number two and number one in my heart when it comes to TV homes would be Bewitched. We had Bewitched for 254 episodes. That is a lot, you guys.
Wow.
I know. September 17th, 1964 through March 25th, 1972.
Oh, my God.
If you need a little refresher, we follow the lives of mortal Darren Stevens and his witchy wife, Samantha. We remember that Elizabeth Montgomery plays Samantha. She also played Lizzie Borden. Remember that? And we have two Darrens. Two actors that portray Darren during the course of the series. And I want to ask you guys. So we have Dick York. He's the one who originated the part, but illness and a bad back and some other things caused him to leave the series after the fifth season. Then we get Dick Sargent, who took over the role. Did you guys have a favorite Darren? Because I had a favorite Darren.
I had a favorite Darren. I was kind of pissy about skinny Darren. I liked the more square-headed Darren. And I don't know which one is which. I don't know Dick Sargent, Dick York, but I do know that I was so confused and I thought it was the same one. He just lost a lot of weight.
They don't look anything alike.
I know, but it was, I didn't
really
get it.
Pointy chin.
Yes, that would be
Dick York.
Okay. That's skinny Darren.
The OG. Yes. And even in the, again, we have an animated beginning of a TV show. Yep. This was created and produced by Hanna-Barbera. And yes, Darren's chin is very pronounced in those cartoons, in the animated version. Okay, you guys, I have something awful to kind of admit. Oh. My favorite was Dick Sargent. I thought he was much better looking.
The square head, right?
I guess, just
rounder heads.
I never really thought about the
Not pointy chin.
Let's just say better looking.
Think of them in terms of geometry. But you could do that. I just thought he was cuter. I'm sorry, Dick York, God rest your soul. I just didn't think he was attractive. He was dorky. And
he was
Dick Sargent was a little more mod and cute to me. So
yeah,
I did have a favorite Darren, and it would be the second. It would be Dick Sargent.
Mine was the second, too. The first Darren's eyes bugged me.
Sorry.
They're really buggy. His eyes were always like little black holes.
When you just did that, that is exactly right.
They look like just those teddy bear eyes you stick in.
Yes.
They're like dark black.
Oh, gosh. Well, we had an array of characters, a great cast of characters in this TV show. And Dora, Samantha's mother. Could we ever forget?
Love her so much.
Love her.
Agnes Moorhead?
Yes, yeah. Agnes Moorhead. Oh. Who to me would always be in Dora. Like that's another one of those actresses that they show you from some movie she was in 1962. And she was supposedly kind of attractive. And you're like, no, she's always
in
Dora. Just like Margaret Hamilton, even though she's what, the Sanka or the Folgers lady. No, she's always the witch from Wizard of Oz.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we've got Mrs. Kravitz and her husband. You guys remember her husband?
What's his name?
Listeners are yelling.
Yes, I know they're yelling,
and I can Abner or something like
that. Abner. Oh, you did it.
Okay, I was about to be like, I can hear her screaming.
Yes, you can hear her saying it.
Abner! Like, I caught her! I caught her!
We had Dr. Bombay.
Oh, yes, Dr. Bombay.
Oh. He's like the wizard in Wicked.
Yes.
He is. Yes.
Mm-hmm. You're right. Or the Wizard of Oz, I could say, yeah.
Aunt Clara. We love her. Little Aunt Clara, didn't we? Coming
She's
down.
She's so befuddled. So
yes. She played so befuddled goofy. Very well.
Yes, she
didn't
did.
She? Mm-hmm. Of course, we had Mr. Tate. That would be Darren's boss at the ad agency. Mm-hmm. Tabitha. We kind of watched Tabitha grow up throughout this episode and get a little brother later on in the series named Adam, who had no...
Totally forgot about that.
I had no...
Adam was
I
immortal. He didn't have any...
I don't even know. Yeah, I wonder things. If I...
That was later. Much later in the series. But yeah, they had a baby, Adam, and he's like a toddler, I think, when the series ends. And then we have Uncle Arthur. That was Paul Lynde.
Oh, yeah. Love him. I know you guys aren't huge fans, but you know how much I love him.
Yeah, you do. He was probably a really good Uncle Arthur. If I look back and think about it, he was an excellent Uncle Arthur. And then we had Esmeralda. So much goodness to that show. And we've talked about this a little bit in shows that, especially in the 70s, that would kind of have social issues melded in, kind of sometimes almost secretly, that you didn't know you were getting bonked over the head with it. And it's often commented that Andorra would kind of use almost Betty Friedan language and how she talked about all these like kind of womanly jobs that Samantha had to do as like the wife.
Yes, that's right.
And was kind of subtly saying like, you can be more than that. You are more than that. You have this power.
He can pick up his own damn socks.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And even though at the time, I think I didn't like Andorra, I thought she was really kind of mean and snippy. Seeing her through those eyes, I thought, she was kind of standing up for, you can be more than just this wife that picks up socks.
Oh, Samantha, you just don't understand. He's turning you into the typical housewife drudge. Oh, I could just see you in a few years, surrounded by diapers and bottles and pacifiers. And wall-to-wall babies.
Okay, well, are you guys ready to hear what made number one?
Let's bring it
home. Listeners, can you guess? Shout it out right now.
Everybody knows.
Drum roll, please, Carolyn. The number one rerun, as voted on by the Pop Culture Preservation Society members and about 15 billion human beings. That's actually, I think, like two times the amount that on Earth, I believe, but that's fair, is The Brady Bunch.
Here's the story of a lovely lady who was bringing up three very lovely girls.
Of course it is.
The end.
Yes, the end.
I think we can just end.
We'll see you next week.
After school, must somehow form a family. That's the way we all became the Brady Bunch.
Oh my goodness. Well, like most of you, The Brady Bunch was an easy number one on my own list. I watched it every single day after school with my sister for as many episodes as they would feed to us. It's the quintessential comfort show. It's one that I don't care how goody-goody you think it is. It's the quintessential comfort show. Would you guys agree?
100%.
Oh,
yeah. And probably mostly because it was just always there for us. It was always there. They never took it off the air. At 2:30 every day, I could run home and I could watch it.
I would say that the Bradys are our generation's family. Not really true. They're boomers' families, but they're also subsequent generations' family. Yeah. And that's one thing that we all love about the Brady Bunch, too, is that it lives on.
Yes.
And you guys, listeners, since we have three podcast episodes already devoted to the Brady Bunch, I am not going to rehash a lot of the stats. I just want to let you know that those are episodes 35, 36, and episode 123, doodle-doodle-doo, The Bradys Go to Hawaii. So why is this show still today in 2024? Why is it still so popular? Well, an article from 2019, so it's still pretty recent, by entertainment writer Sandra Ebiger, and I will again link this article in the Weekly Reader because I loved it, says, "The Brady Bunch was my brief drama-free break from real life. It was my pixelated security blanket." As entertainment writer Jess Cagle wrote, "The show was a picture of stability while Vietnam and the sexual revolution rocked the rest of the world. While our real-life parents were splitting up at an alarming rate, those goody-goody Bradys were telling us a shameless lie about family life. We desperately believed it, And I would add, we desperately needed it.
Yeah, that's so true.
It was a balm to a lot of us who desperately needed that type of security in our days and in our families.
Mm-hmm. So what if we all left work at 3:30 and immediately sat down on the couch for 2 hours of vintage family sitcoms? No guilt allowed. What if that was a thing that we could do? What would that do for our mental health to take that kind of break? I feel like it would be the kind of mindless escape that we all need right after a hard day of work. You empty out your brain, you let go of the emergencies, you lie down, you take a load off. And then when you're freshly rejuvenated, then you can get up and make dinner. Dinner's at 6:30, but you take those 2 hours off to watch stupid TV because life is so fast right now and it feels like we're constantly running out of time. Could we just slow things down if we instituted an after-work ritual of after-school programming?
Mm-hmm.
Don't you
or
think?
Or nighttime. I think I'm going to write down all these shows we've just talked about and little slips of paper and put them in a cup. And at night, Brian and I are going to each pick one. And so that's two shows. So maybe one night we watched an episode of Bewitched and one of I Dream of Jeannie. Mm-hmm. And the next night it's an episode of Dick Van Dyke and The Brady Bunch. Wouldn't that be kind of fun?
I love that idea.
Not every night, but like four nights.
I just love the idea of like of giving yourself permission to do something that we nowadays as an adult we would look at as a waste of time. And it could be that that time that we took after school to unwind before dinner might have been kind of good for us. Because either way, these shows, whether you love them, hated them, or watched them simply because they were on, contributed immensely to our daily lives, mostly because of the massive amount of real estate they took up in our day. And I don't think any of these would be considered educational or highbrow forms of art by any means. But look at us. We still turned out just fine. Thank you for listening today, and we will see you next time.
I thought today's episode was so fun, and I want to thank those people who helped bring it to us today. I want to thank Susan and Joanna and Jane and Jamie and Jill and Sharon. And I want to thank Christine, Elaine, and Barbara too. Because you know what? Those are just some of our Patreon supporters and one-time donors who make this podcast possible. We have so much fun doing this podcast that we are so grateful to our supporters.
Absolutely. And if you'd like to explore our Patreon page and check out the perks our patrons get as a thank you for their support, just go to Patreon, patreon.com, or our website, poppreservationists.com.
In the meantime, let's raise our glasses for a toast, courtesy of Jack Tripper, Janet Wood, and Chrissy Snow. To good times.
To happy days.
To Little House on the Prairie.
Cheers! Cheers. The information, opinions, and comments expressed on the Pop Culture Preservation Society podcast belong solely to Carolyn, the Crushologist, and Hello Newman, and are in no way representative of our employers or affiliates. And though we truly believe we are always right, there is always a first time. The PCPS is written, produced, and recorded in Minneapolis, Minnesota, home of the fictional WJM Studios and our beloved Mary Richards. Nanu, nanu, keep on trucking, and may the force be with you.